You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 4th of October 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from Studio One here in London, this is The Globalist. I'm Emma Nelson, and a very warm welcome to the programme. Coming up.
This nuclear sabre rattling is not the kind of thing that that we would expect to hear from leaders of large countries with capability.
The US warns Russia may not be bluffing about launching a nuclear attack on Ukraine. We'll look at the nature of Moscow's threat and if the rest of the world can dial things down. Also ahead, a second coup in a year in Burkina Faso. We'll ask what Captain Ibrahim Traoré plans to do now he's seized power from a former comrade and how long he'll last. We'll have the latest as Taiwan launches its first English language television channel. Plus, we explore London's newest exhibition, Same Same.
We wanted to kind of show the shift, I guess, between one work and the next. You know, it's a show that wants to lift the lid on process a bit.
That's all coming up, including the morning newspapers and the business news too. So stay tuned to The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. North Korea has fired a suspected missile over Japan in what appears to be a deliberate escalation. The launch has seen Japan issue a rare alert to some citizens to take cover. Lawyers for the Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman says his appointment as Prime Minister guarantees him immunity from prosecution in the case of the killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And a Russian journalist who staged an on-air protest against Russia's war in Ukraine has been put on Moscow's wanted list after escaping from pre-trial house arrest. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, the US has warned that Russia may not be bluffing when it threatens to use nuclear weapons against Ukraine. Menacing words have been coming from Moscow since the very start of the invasion. But as Russia seems more and more under pressure because of an invasion that's going wrong, the actions and decisions by Vladimir Putin have become wilder and wilder. I'm delighted to say that we are joined on the line from Berlin by Matthew Harris, who's Director of Proliferation and Nuclear Policy at the Royal United Services Institute. Good morning to you, Matthew.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Why do you think the US has spoken out now about Russia and its nuclear threats against Ukraine?
Well, actually, I don't think that the US response now is very much out of the ordinary compared to what's been happening in the war so far. We've heard nuclear rhetoric from the Russian leadership from the outset of this war. And the US position to date has been that they haven't seen anything that would cause would require a change in U.S. nuclear posture. And the U.S. has emphasized, I think by its lack of nuclear saber-rattling in response, that it has no interest in seeing this conflict go nuclear. Of course, there is a lot more attention being paid to the Russian threat, Russian nuclear threat, because of Vladimir Putin's most recent remarks when he announced that Russia would accept the results of the sham referendums and annex the occupied territories. But I think, you know, we are essentially in a similar dynamic as we were at the beginning of the war. What has changed and why there's so much more attention being paid and why the perception of risk is higher is that the war is, of course, going worse and worse from Moscow's point of view. And that means the stakes are rising in Moscow and the sense of threat in Moscow is rising. And of course, that makes Putin's nuclear threats to some extent more credible, because the worse the scenario is, the more willing Vladimir Putin might be to do something very reckless and stupid.
Matthew, could I just ask you, what is the nature of the threat that we're actually talking about here? What could Russia do?
Well, Russia could do all sorts of things. What we've heard from Russia is essentially a threat, referring back to its nuclear capability as a warning to outside powers, NATO and the United States, to keep out of the war. And I think to some extent a warning to the Ukrainian leadership to try to intimidate that leadership. So people have speculated that if Russia was to use nuclear weapons, that it might be on the so-called lower end of the nuclear spectrum. That might mean a use of a tactical nuclear weapon, which is a very short range nuclear weapon, potentially with a lower explosive yield, meaning a smaller bang than other nuclear weapons, or even a nuclear test that wasn't used in a military sense at all, or a so-called demonstration shot that was exploded in a way to minimize casualties, or alternatively a nuclear use against a military or even civilian target. Those are the potential options that are on the table. I think the thing to emphasize is that two things. One is whatever type of nuclear weapon Russia used, if it was to use one, would be crossing a very grave threshold and would be very, very different from the use of conventional weapons in this war. It would be breaking a taboo that's held since 1945. It would be launching us into a new world, and I think would come with extremely grave consequences for Russia. And the second thing is to take the nuclear threat very seriously, because any conflict involving a nuclear power comes with very serious risks. But on the other hand, to remind ourselves, and in particular to remind Russia, of the fact that Russia too would be entering a new world, a very different kind of conflict, a very severe consequences, whether they be diplomatic or even potentially military. And so, I think we should keep reinforcing the message that for Russia, this would be a very bad move.
I'm delighted to say we can now be joined on the line from Kyiv by Lada Roslitsky, who's founder of Black Trident, a defence and security consulting group in Ukraine. Good morning, Lada.
Good morning.
Just from what Matthew was describing there, the various permutations of the threat, how prepared is Ukraine for any of those to happen?
Well, it's not prepared at all. And even in Kyiv, where the Russian rockets have destroyed windows have not been replaced by the government, and rooftops are still missing. Winter is coming. So when we bring it into the nuclear conversation, we are not prepared. There are certain stations, for instance, on YouTube, that are already telling people how to react under different types of nuclear attacks. It looks like the more likely scenario, if they use them, as your speaker was saying, would be tactical nuclear weapons, which would need us to be hiding in basements for 2 to 3 days. And the fact that they're tactical is actually that they're meant to be used in wartime for the military, the enemy military, to come in after those days of destruction. It is really horrific. It's difficult to believe that we're listening to this type of information, and the international community continues to say grave thresholds, grave concerns, but a lot of Ukrainians are in graves. And if the international community does not step up to, one, remove the Russian Federation from the veto right, or even the General Assembly of the United Nations, that would really allow us to be defended better. Also, we need to realize that there is a duty to prevent genocide. And what is happening in Ukraine is genocide en masse, not only in the territories that we have full outright battles going on, but just every morning we wake up and we hear people having been killed by rockets, for instance, today in Kharkiv, in Sumiv, in Dnipro, Petrovsk. So the escalation is coming. It will be spinning out of the borders of Ukraine, as we already see it happening. And the international communities and leaders really need to step up to the plate, which they're not doing. And what we see with the Musk tweeting is just causing more, let's say, desperation inside of Ukraine than doing anything positive, good, based on international rule of law.
Lada, tell me a little bit more about that desperation. The fact fact is that Russia's war, to all intents and purposes, looks like it's imploding. And the risk of more unexpected, more sort of actions from the clear blue sky seem to be greater. How is Ukraine preparing itself for, you know, more and more surprises?
Well, Ukraine as a whole, as a state, is trying to garnish more support from the international community and providing more oversight and cooperation with the support that they are receiving. On the civilian level, where basically we can say we have some sort of peace, people are really stocking up again for the winter. Everybody is terrified that we will be left without electricity and gas together. So it's going as far as even buying hay, squares of hay to put in front of your balcony or in your apartments to keep warmth. In Kyiv Oblast, for instance, there's no more wood. Firewood to be purchased. We have to be looking outside. So and mentally, there's a very great lack of civil military training preparation. It is absurd if we look at it from a side that we're going to be entering the second year of this war in a few months, and the Ukrainians remain relatively self-training, which is ridiculous. And we have, again, mobilization. We must remember that Ukrainian men are being mobilized. Students that would study in universities, colleges in Europe are no longer able to leave as of 22nd of September. Women may be forced to stay inside of the country, which is something that makes a lot of people and families very nervous. So the situation, again, is extremely unjust, and justice is what we're waiting for. But when we look at the Russians calling out for that this is a holy war, and that they are fighting against Satanists and perverts in the Red Square. This was said a few days ago. We are really seeing that this escalation is going to trickle through further to other countries, particularly Syria, which we need to be keeping our eyes out on.
Lada, I'm keen to get the view from Matthew in here as well. I mean, just listening to what Lada has been saying, the fact remains that she talked about the fact that Ukrainian soldiers are mostly self-trained. There is a dire need for help from the international community. Now that the nuclear threat is becoming more and more, more and more mentioned, how do you think that the rest of the world can try and step up its help for Ukraine?
I think that probably the most important lesson is to try to understand what Vladimir Putin is trying to do with these nuclear threats. Putin is trying to manipulate our sense of risk, manipulate Ukrainian sense of risk, and manipulate the international community's sense of risk. There is a serious risk that has to be addressed, but I think what's very important is that to bear in mind, as I was when I was listening to Lada, that, you know, it's the Ukrainians who are fighting, it's the Ukrainians who are dying, and so it's Ukrainians who take decisions about where this war goes from here. The Ukrainians have not attacked Russia. The Ukrainians are fighting to regain their own territory. And so there's a very important need, I think, to balance the risk of escalation, which has to be taken seriously, further escalation, I say, because, of course, for Ukrainians, this war has escalated very far already. The risk of further escalation, on the one hand, against the fact that part of what Vladimir Putin is trying to do is to scare and to intimidate. And so I think it's important to hold the line and not be scared into taking or seeking to take decisions out of Ukrainian hands.
Matthew Harris and Lada Roslitsky, thank you both for joining me on Monocle 24. You're with The Globalist. It's 6:15 a.m. in Ouagadougou, 7:15 a.m. here at Midori House in London. For the second time this year, Burkina Faso has a new military ruler. Captain Ibrahim Traoré overthrew his former comrade, Lieutenant Colonel Paul-Henri Damiba, after accusing him of failing to defeat the Islamist insurgency in the country. At 34 years old, he becomes Africa's youngest leader. But for how long? And why is Russia so key to Burkina Faso's future? Well, I'm joined by Alex Vines, OBE, who's director of the Africa programme at Chatham House. A very warm welcome to Monocle 24. Good morning, Alex.
Morning.
Good to have you with you. Good to have you with us, I should say. Coup number two for the country in a year.
Yes, I mean, I don't think it's a big surprise. It was looking very fragile. The military junta of the former military ruler, Dambisa, was very fragmented. And it's a bit like what happened in neighbouring Mali, which has had several coups, which is that increasingly the military hadn't been able to provide security. The Islamic insurgency was getting worse. And so you had an additional coup. So that's where we are right at the moment in Burkina Faso, unfortunately.
We have this very young ruler. Who is Ibrahim Traoré?
Well, he's a young leader. He's been up fighting on the front line. He says that he's going to return to focus on fighting. And so the coup, in reality, was pretty popular. There were lots of people who came out and supported it. Again, a bit like what we saw in neighbouring Mali last year, was that there are parts of the population that support these coups because they want better security. And so that's what he's promising. He's also promising that he's going to review the international partnerships that Burkina has. Now, with the West, though, they've been pretty tricky because the previous junta regime of Dambisa was also had regional sanctions put on it. The West had also sent various warnings about non-constitutional changes of government. Traoré is now suggesting that he may look more broadly at international partners, which I think means possibly the Russian Federation, but also countries like Turkey.
You're talking about the fact that he wants fast solutions to big problems, because time is clearly not on your side when you are a leader in Burkina Faso. Great things are expected from you at great speed. As well as Turkey, though, we have some fearing that this is a turn towards Russia. The fact that we've had the Russian mercenary group, the Wagner, have welcomed the takeover in Burkina Faso. What does this mean?
Yeah, the leader of Wagner has called Traoré a true kind of patriot of the land. Look, Russia is meddling in the Sahel. Anything that overstretches further the West, and in particular France, is welcomed by Moscow. And although Wagner has retreated, withdrawn, reduced its forces in Libya, it's maintained a fairly strong posture of around 700 of them in neighbouring Mali. And it looks as if they're looking to be involved in Burkina Faso. No, there were amongst the demonstrators in support of the coup, there were demonstrators that were brandishing Russian flags, for example, in Ouagadougou over the weekend. So we'll have to see. I have my doubts whether the Russians will be able to improve the security situation at all significantly. The Wagner hasn't really been able to do that in any of the places it's operated in the African continent so far. But it is indicative of the need to try and improve security that you get putschists looking towards Moscow.
Indeed. I mean, we have apparently the authorities in Burkina Faso actually controls about 60% of its territory. Where else does Burkina Faso look if it doesn't look to Russia for help?
That's the point. So it is logical in that situation that you look to see who else might have a security offer for you, given that the French are unpopular and you believe that the French have not been particularly successful. The West has been really wondering about what to do with Burkina Faso, and hasn't provided a lot of assistance, and so therefore the menu at the moment is pretty limited. That the problem it goes back to that Wagner and Russia really can't deliver the sort of security that's needed to turn this insurgency against Burkina Faso's government and to restore order and to bring a degree of stability. So I think that's the paradox here for the junta.
What's the wider implications for Africa itself with a brand new young leader with this, not dependence, but seeking Russia's help with this? Because it also plays very well into Russia's hands, doesn't it? Because if it knows, Russia knows that it can look to countries in Africa to support it when it comes to the war in Ukraine, or even if the countries don't openly support Russia, Russia knows that African leaders, some of them, will not turn against Moscow.
Well, the default position on the African continent is non-alignment, which is to abstain or not turn up for a vote. And I don't have a problem with that. But Mali, neighbouring Mali, the Prime Minister was at the UN General Assembly last week, and he more or less insulted everybody, the UN Secretary General, the neighbouring states, and he called the French a junta. The only people that he congratulated were the Russians, which must have really pleased Moscow. So you're right, there are a handful of countries, especially if they're led by putschists that have been sanctioned by the West, that will play up their Russia connections. The problem is that there is a contradiction, as I've said in this, which is the Russians, they travel lightly and they don't have deep pockets. And so they aren't able to provide the development and the assistance that's needed for really long-term strategies to bring both security, but particularly development. The solutions in the Sahel are not long-term military ones. They are developmental ones, but they do need security to be part of that package, given the ferocity of some of the insurgent groups that are operating in the region. You both have groups affiliated to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. They are very vicious, and at times they clash with each other, as well as challenging the authorities of those countries. And so this is a really tricky, wicked situation to be getting into. And the Russians, I believe, are very much out of their depth. I think we'll see them retreating eventually out of Mali as the wheel turns against them.
Alex Vines, OBE, Director of the Africa Programme at Chatham House. Thank you so much for joining us on The Globalist. You're with Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
It's 7:22 here in London. Now, a court in Pakistan has accepted a written apology from the former Prime Minister Imran Khan over comments he made against a female judge. The court's acceptance of Mr. Khan's apology now means that contempt of court charges he did face will now be dropped. Well, Aisha Siddiqui is a senior fellow at the Department of War Studies at King's College in London. A very good morning to you, Aisha. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, good morning.
Aisha, just explain to us, what exactly was it that Mr. Khan said, and why did it lead him in such trouble?
Well, Mr. Khan, in his typical way, had threatened a junior judge, a female judge. And basically, he had incited his followers and said that, you know, it was the wording was that, you know, we will sort you out, which meant that her life would be in danger, and his followers are known to be violent, and that is when, you know, the higher court took notice of it, and he was issued with a condemned charge against him.
The fact remains that he has written now a letter, an apology. How is that going to play out? I mean, is this going to draw a line under it? It says that the contempt charges will be dropped, but what does that mean for Mr. Khan now?
Well, Mr. Khan is now, that kind of a constraint against him and his politics. I mean, there was this fear constantly that he will get arrested. So that is gone, which means that he will continue to oppose the sitting government, and he'll continue to rally, and he will, continue to contest, contest politically as normally as it can be. I think what is important to understand is that unlike the past, now in the past, Pakistan's higher judiciary would issue contempt notices, would summon politicians. This particular bench is not keen to do that. Well, this particular bench says that, look, we are not going to drag politicians under contempt, over contempt charges. We will advise them and we expect them to behave themselves, but we will not issue contempt notices. That's what this bench is doing.
One thing, though, he's not completely out of the woods, is he? Because he's facing a case related to alleged foreign funding for his party. The next hearing in the case is on November the 6th. How much is this cumulatively damaging his reputation?
You know, incidentally, it's not damaging his reputation. People who support Imran Khan continue to support him. I mean, I'm sure there are few who are kind of looking at him more skeptically, but it's overall his support base remains solid behind him. And that's why the concern now is that when Nawaz Sharif of Pakistan Muslim League N, who sits in London at the moment, when he returns to Pakistan and when we have elections next year, Punjab, which is the main base of Pakistan's politics, it's the largest province in terms of population. That may have turned in favor of Imran Khan. So, you know, we'll know what happens when next elections happen, of course. Now, Imran insists that early elections should happen. But what the military wants, Pakistan military wants, is that in November, which is end of November, the current army chief has to retire. So either he gets an extension or a new army chief is selected for, which means another 3 years, 3 to 4 years. So for the army, that is important, that date is passed and then elections can happen. Now, Imran Khan wants elections in October, which is now impossible for two reasons. One, October, we are in October, and there is no sign that there are going to be elections. Secondly, Pakistan has just been through devastating floods, and the entire infrastructure is destroyed. So I don't think that anybody is ready. People are ready. Ordinary people are ready. The country is ready for elections. So it's got to be next year. So it's next year. Until then, Imran Khan has to keep motivating his supporters. He has to keep holding, meetings, political meetings, gatherings. And so the issue is that how will he keep up the momentum until next year when elections happen? That's the question for him.
Finally, you mentioned the floods. The UN humanitarian coordinator for Pakistan has said that Pakistan is entering a second wave of death and destruction, an increase in children dying, and there needs to be a big coordinated global reaction to this. How much time has Pakistan got?
I think, I'm not sure that, time is really the issue here, because this is going to, death and destruction is going to come in waves. Now we are entering a phase where Pakistan is entering a phase where, you have illnesses as, water dries up. And by the way, in many parts of the country, especially the province of Sindh, water is still there. It's not dried up. And as it dries up, there's going to be illnesses. There are going to be viral infections. And there is a lot of death and destruction. So that will take another 6 to 7 months. So there's going to be more trouble. And let's not forget that this is not one freak event, this rain. South Asia, Pakistan in particular, is going to face more of it in coming years. And I think this is where help of international community is critical. Pakistan doesn't have resources. right now, international community has made commitments, but we're still waiting to see, resources, finances, financial help, and other help come in.
Aisha Siddiqa, thank you so much for joining us. The time is 7:30 here in London. Still to come, the business news, and also we'll go through the papers too. But first, let's have a look at some of the headlines. North Korea has fired a suspected missile over Japan in what appears to be a deliberate escalation. It's the first North Korean missile launch over Japan since 2017. It saw Japan issue a rare alert to some citizens to take cover. Iran's supreme leader has blamed the US and Israel for the protests sweeping the country following the death of a woman while in police custody. Speaking publicly for the first time on the unrest, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said riots had been engineered by Iran's arch enemies and their allies. And the former US President Donald Trump is suing CNN for defamation, seeking $475 million in punitive damages. Mr. Trump claims the network carried out a campaign of libel and slander against him and used its considerable influence as a leading news organization to defeat him politically. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, Taiwan has launched its first English-language television channel. It's to try to raise the country's international profile and forge even closer ties with the West. The government-backed Taiwan Plus will compete with China, which is also becoming increasingly active in English-language media to promote the ruling Communist Party. William Yang is the East Asia correspondent for Deutsche Welle, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now. Very good morning to you, William.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Or afternoon, I should say. So just tell us a little bit about Taiwan Plus. What will we be able to watch if we touch down in Taipei and turn on our TVs?
So Taiwan Plus offers their round-the-clock news program. I think there are currently 9 hours where they will be producing the daily updates about news in Taiwan, both in a quick breaking news and also longer form features. And most of the news are coming either out of Taiwan or issues that concerns Taiwan's position in the region or in the world. But apart from that, there have been some documentaries and feature films and also TV series where all of these content have been adapted into English. So the aim is to actually not go beyond what the world has been learning or getting to know about Taiwan, which most of the time is about cross-strait relations or China's threats against Taiwan or Taiwan's struggle to get international status. But the Taiwan Plus basically wants the world to know more beyond the news about what is Taiwan and what is about Taiwan and the Taiwanese culture and the Taiwanese people as well.
It's a very simple but important and effective step, isn't it? If you teach the world about it, you know, your cultural influence, your identity, your soft power increases, dare I say. I mean, how much do you think Taiwan will actually get out of this?
I think it's actually really hard to say. As we have seen, there have been many other ventures before this from different countries, and most of them have been quite successful up until this point. Taiwan rather joined the game a little bit much later than other countries, including countries like Japan, Singapore, and like you just mentioned, China, where they all have their own broadcasting in English facing the international audience. One of the biggest challenges, I think, for Taiwan is to how to differentiate itself from the rest of the existing public broadcasters from different countries, and at the same time, make sure that there is a unique angle to the approach of their news coverage, of their content production, and also of their storytelling. Because I think oftentimes for the international audience, China and Taiwan is basically similar or basically the same thing. And for them, it's really, really hard and tough to really find a very convincing way to understand the differences. So the task and I think the priority for them is to really differentiate and let Taiwan's voice stand out on its own rather than being ended up just viewing as part of the emerging Asia voice.
And it has a big job ahead of it in terms of countering the very loud voice that is coming out of China. China is getting more and more active in English language media. How do you think China is going to respond to this?
I think it's pretty expectable that Beijing will also increase its own narrative, especially on issues related to Taiwan. We have seen not only their news coverage coming out of the CGTN, their international broadcaster, but also there have been documentaries or TV series where they try to project the Chinese narrative about the status of Taiwan and also try to convince the world about China's dominance or authority over Taiwan. So for Taiwan Plus, obviously, this is going to be one of the main tasks, is how does Taiwan really project its own image through this international broadcaster, while at the same time making sure that it achieves the goal of making helping the international community understand why China's narrative about Taiwan's status is not always correct or is not even always factual.
William Yang, president of the Taiwan Foreign Correspondents Club and East Asia correspondent at Deutsche Welle. Thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. Let's continue with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is Simon Brook, journalist and communications consultant. And Simon, I'm not normally one who sort of comments on appearances because it's radio. We've got to make this up. Yeah, exactly. Who knows what we're wearing?
Anything, yeah.
But you are looking as smart as paint today.
And you are looking even better, I have to say.
Yeah, you need bigger, better glasses. Right, how are you? Tell us about what you've been finding in the papers.
Yeah, I thought given the Tory party conference taking place in the UK this week, it might be quite interesting to look at the Daily Telegraph, which, as you know, is the sort of the in-house publication of the Conservative Party. I have to say, it leads with a story which basically sums up the situation in Birmingham, where the Conservative Party is meeting for its annual conference. And it really presents us with a party in chaos in many ways, with ministers and MPs at each other's throats and recriminations. It reports that Tory rebels who forced Liz Truss, the Prime Minister, into her top tax rate U-turn, including Michael Gove, the former Levelling Up Secretary, were already breaking ranks yesterday and warning against a decision that might be made not to raise universal credit in line with inflation. This is the main support for social support for people in the UK. Inflation running at 9%, but the idea is that it would be more in line with earnings. Liz Truss also has a piece, an article in The Telegraph, with her first comments about the 45% tax cut reversal. She says the policy had become an unnecessary distraction. The paper also says that she has hinted at humility about the backlash that this decision and the U-turn has caused, saying that I want to bring the public with me. I want to win hearts and minds because I really believe in my plan is the right one for the country. But she's certainly got her work cut out, I have to say.
She has. I mean, let's put this in context of what you have done. You have worked in communications for the Conservative Party. Dare I say it, when the woman that Liz Truss would dream of being was just about still clinging to power.
She was, that's right.
Just tell us a little bit about how you think the communications should be managed at the moment. The fact is that we have the Daily Telegraph, which, as you say, is a de facto in-house publication for the Conservative Party, is already pulling apart the policies of the new government. I mean, this does not bode well, does it?
No, I have to say, I mean, having, yeah, as you say, sort of run the communications at party conferences, you're always trying to sort of, you want to have some debate, you want to make it clear this isn't a sort of, you know, like the Chinese Communist Party, but at the same time, you want to keep control of it and try and show a united party. And I have to say, I really feel for my successors in the Tory party press office running around trying to manage this. The problem is, if you are in that comms team, you really are subject to what your bosses do and what the Prime Minister has done. And I think by any means, she has messed this up. The fact that, as we know, they didn't communicate with the markets, the fact she stayed stumm for over a week or nearly a week. And then when she did do some interviews, they were very stilted and she didn't really sort of address the issues. So I think it's very difficult here. I think this is the problem is you can't control the various people who run around to a TV studio or talk to a journalist off the record to give their views. So they're in a very difficult situation. I think it just puts extra pressure on Liz Truss for her final big set piece, party conference piece, to see if she can show more of that humility acknowledge that there are differences, but then try and pull things together and unify the party in some way.
I'm veering from the paper review because I just want to know how a communications department deals with policies which, on the face of it, are going to make the markets collapse and make the pound collapse and make mortgage rates go up, which is exactly what happened last week. When you are dealt an enormous basket of something that isn't very pleasant and you have to try and sell it to the rest of the world, I mean, what goes through your head?
I think, well, as I say, humility. You've got, she's sort of admitted finally that she's made a mistake, and I think there's got to be a bit more of that. But then you've got to have clarity. I mean, what the markets want, what homeowners, businesses, we all want to hear from the government is some sense of this is what we're going to do and this is why it will make your life or your financial position or whatever better. So I think she's got to be really clear on that. I think she's got to also give us some sense of direction and acknowledge that, you know, there are dissenting voices, that this is a debate. And I think if she can acknowledge those, but then pull it together and find the kind of overall themes, the strands that unite the Tory party, but also sort of resonate with people in the country who are very concerned about their economic, their financial situation, then I think that's the approach she's going to have to take. But I think there's going to be speech writing till late in the evening before she delivers that speech.
Lots of grim cups of coffee being delivered. Let's move on to a brilliant article by Gideon Rackman in the Financial Times. Starting off by saying he used to think conspiracy theories were the refuge of the powerless and the uneducated, but now those in power are now peddling them. I think we can easily date that to Donald Trump, but it seems to have become stitched into the rhetoric of so many leaders now.
Absolutely, yeah. Gideon Rackman, always worth listening to. And he said, yeah, exactly. Conspiracy theorists have moved from the streets to the suites, he says. And yes, Donald Trump and QAnon and things. He also points out, though, that probably the most dangerous of these powerful conspiracy theorists is Vladimir Putin. And he refers to Putin's speech last week, you know, that the collective West doesn't want us to be free. They want us to be a colony. They want to steal from us. And Rackman also quotes something called the theory of the golden billion. And this is apparently that the world only has enough resources to support a billion people, and therefore it tends to break up Russia and steal its resources. Obviously, we've got the Brazilian elections continuing, and of course, Jair Bolsonaro is another conspiracy theorist promoting a vast leftist conspiracy to steal the election from him. Also, Giorgia Meloni as well has flirted with the great replacement theory. So, quite a worrying piece. Rackman doesn't offer a sort of solution to this, but I suppose if there was one, possibly, it's, I suppose, what you need is an educated, well-informed electorate which is sort of at ease with itself, and then it can see through this nonsense.
Yes, I think we wish ourselves the best of luck with that one. I do wish actually that Mr. Rackman actually come up with a bit of some sort of hope, because actually it becomes a bit of a shopping list of where it's all going wrong.
That's the problem.
Right, where it's all going wrong as well is in France. Le Monde is talking about fractured France. I always thought that was their permanent state of affairs, but is it getting worse?
That was my feeling, Emma, exactly. So, yeah, new polling commissioned by Le Monde, and the lead story in the paper today shows that France is angry and full of dissent, and is probably the best word to describe it. Over a third say that the country is angry, and over half believe it's unhappy, according to the polling. But the good news is it is getting slightly better. The number of people who believe that democracy should not be replaced and it is the best possible system is held by 70%. That's up 2% on last year. And also the number of people who believe that politicians are corrupt is down 5%, even though it is 57%. So that's just over half, isn't it? But, well, I suppose it's going in the right direction.
I was about to say, that's not bad for France. My favourite word of the day is décrispation, which is to relax.
Relax,
a bit
absolutely.
More.
Yeah, they should do a bit more of that.
They should do a little bit more of that. It's a delightful article because it just talks about a dollop of common sense that's happening to the French
psyche.
Yeah,
it is. And also things are basically going slowly in the right direction, it says.
Good. Finally, New York City is a town that loves to play games,
yes,
apparently, according to the New York Times. This is a really lovely, lovely article.
It is. So this is, the King's Cup, which is the tournament of the NYC Trivia League, which has hundreds of teams, according to the New York Times, and more than 2,600 players in this season alone. The Brooklyn Brewery in Williamsburg is where the 10-week season concluded quite recently. And it's a wonderful description of why people just love trivia. I have to say, I think as journalists, we're quite good at this kind of thing, aren't we? Because our knowledge is kind of a mile wide and an inch deep. So we're probably quite good at these competitions, are we? Or is that just me showing off?
I suspect that's you being probably a little bit mile wide and more than an inch deep. I find myself being put on teams because of what I do and then coming up sorely lacking. But I do quite like the idea that people get together and play games. And actually, the New York Times has managed to sort of absolutely collar the market in trivia and brain teasing. It's a delightful pursuit, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And as one of the contestants says, they love trivia because of its ability to democratise information. All sorts of information, and information has value, all the way from knowing who the first pharaoh was to knowing the winner of RuPaul's Drag Race. And I think that's a lovely thing, isn't it? It is competitive, but at the same time, the fact that everybody can contribute in some way. And this is the kind of debate and discussion we probably should be having, really, shouldn't we?
Simon Brook, thank you so much for joining me in the studio. You're listening to The Globalist. We're live on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Let's talk business now with Isabel Asher-Hamilton, a senior reporter at The Daily Upside. Good morning, Isabel.
Morning.
Right, what's on your list of things you want to talk to us about?
So first up is this story about Elizabeth Holmes, the former president and founder of Theranos. I don't know if your listeners know Theranos, but it's quite well known as a sort of emperor's new clothes story about a startup that promised brilliant medical breakthroughs, a kind of blood testing kit at home, and all came crashing down. She got convicted 9 months ago on 4 counts of wire fraud and conspiracy, but she's just managed to get a hearing so that she can request a new trial.
Tell us what that means for her, but more widely, when you have startups which promise the earth, the Theranos trial was an enormous warning, wasn't it?
The Theranos trial was pretty blockbuster, yeah, especially since what was being promised was more than just an app. It was literally medical technology. And some of the people who tested this blood testing kit that you were meant to be able to use at home got awful results that weren't true. There was one woman who was told that she'd had a miscarriage when she hadn't. For Elizabeth Holmes, she's been trying to sort of fight back against the convictions that she was served 9 months ago. She tried to get an acquittal already. That didn't work. But now her lawyer is arguing that she deserves a new trial. And part of that is that they claim that one of the witnesses that came forward in the initial trial and was questioned by the government came to her house in August and expressed some kind of regret. They say this witness, who's the ex-lab director at Theranos, said that he felt his testimony had been twisted. He has since actually signed a statement saying he doesn't think that's the case. But Holmes's lawyer has successfully argued that it's a strange enough occurrence that there should at least be a new hearing on whether there should be another trial.
Let's move on to news from the communication sector with Vodafone talking about a merger.
Yes, so Vodafone and Three have confirmed that they are in merger talks. And if it's successful, they would create the biggest mobile operator in the UK. And this is a fairly big deal. Over the last 5 or 6 years, Ofcom has been pretty staunchly against any of the four big mobile operators in the UK merging, saying that this would be uncompetitive, it might damage prices for consumers, but they backed off on that in February, and now it seems like Vodafone and Three are taking full advantage.
Tell us a little bit what this would mean for the mobile phones market, not just in the United Kingdom, but globally. There are always the checks and balances and the due diligence that has to be done when two enormous giants start to talk to each other.
Yes, well, they're saying it's not going to be a cash buy and that they're going to divide up pretty evenly, with Vodafone owning about 51% of whatever new company would be formed, and Three's parent company of 49%. It does make a pretty big player. Vodafone's argument is that it needs to grow in order to scale its 5G operation, and that it can't really compete at the moment with the other operators in the UK. So, yeah, it would make a pretty big player overall.
It would make a pretty big player, but the regulator, which would be conducting some in-depth investigations, has explicitly stated that the United Kingdom needs four leading mobile players in order for the market to operate efficiently and fairly. As a result of that kind of statement, how likely do you think the merger will be?
Well, the thing is that the regulator has said that four players are important, but it's also in February sort of opened the door to this merger. And it's not as though there aren't smaller companies that couldn't come up or international companies that couldn't branch out to the UK. So I think it's possible. And I think that Vodafone and Three wouldn't be talking so openly if they didn't feel fairly certain. Three tried to acquire O2 6 years ago and that got blocked. So you'd imagine they'd be fairly gun-shy about talking about these things.
Let's move on to Tesla. It's always interesting to see what's going on in Tesla's world, up and down. It's down again.
Yes, it's been down pretty much all year, to be honest. So Tesla announced it delivered about 343,000 vehicles in third quarter, and that's a record. It's never delivered that many. The problem is that it fell short of expectations by about 15,000 vehicles delivered, and that sent its stock down again. So its stock sank, I think, about 9% on that news, and it's down 25% since the start of the year. So that's really quite dramatic for a promising company and, you know, the biggest automaker of electric vehicles in the world at this stage.
Indeed. I mean, what does it say, briefly, if you wouldn't mind, about the fact that we are all looking to electric vehicles as a future of our personal transport? But if Tesla can't get it right, what do the likes of, BMW and Mercedes have to work on?
Well, the likes of BMW and Mercedes are legacy firms that have very big factories and have their own logistics network set up for delivering cars. Tesla is very new and it has more of a production or a delivery problem than a demand problem. So really, if people started to shift to the other big automakers, I imagine there'd be less of a problem.
Isabel Asher-Hamilton, thank you so much for joining us. You're with The Globalist on Monocle 24. Finally, on today's show, we hear of a new exhibition here in London. Artists have been asked to execute the same idea twice, from glass sculptures to large canvases. The show is called Same Same, and it captures the shift that takes place during the process of creation. Tamsin Howard went along to Sid Motion Gallery here in London to find out more.
My name's Sid Motion. I run Sid Motion Gallery, which I've run for 6.5 years now. This is an exhibition that I've co-curated with the artist, art historian, Rose Davey. Rose gave a series of lectures during lockdown, some of which had already been performed at the Slade. And Rose touched upon a painting called The Chumley Ladies, which was painted in 1600, which is a very famous image of two women lying in bed, both cradling babies. How Rose brilliantly described it in the lecture is that it starts to be a game of spot the difference. The women look very similar, but actually there's a huge amount of variation between the two of them. So we started talking about this idea of doubling and the idea of doubling, twinning, starting to ask artists to execute the same idea twice. So we came up with a list of artists that we set a challenge for to execute either a new work twice or retry an older work. And Rose, importantly, is an artist that's included in the exhibition as well.
I'm Rose Davey and I am an artist, writer, art historian. It's executing the same idea twice, and you could say in one sense that all artists execute the same idea twice, and that's what keeps them making, because they're never quite satisfied that they've kind of like ticked the box and they've completely communicated or interpreted that idea, and that's why they keep making. So we wanted to kind of show the shift, I guess, between one work and the next. You know, it's a show that wants to lift the lid on process a bit. So what we're looking at are a grid of 18 paintings, 3x6, laying one colour down and then putting a frame of colour over the top. It's because we accept the frame is a space where anything can happen. It's a method of practice that I use in kind of an obsessive way, but I will go away from it and I'll make loads of drawings and collages. These paintings are based on a single memory of two colours meeting in the landscape. I'm kind of feeling my way through it across these panels, so they're hung sequentially. In my mind, I get the colour combination of that recollection of a building against the sky around the middle, and then I try again, and then I get bored and I go off on a different tangent. What is the investigation that goes on? What, whether it's compositiony or a change of material, what can shift to execute the same idea but in a very different way? So because the gallery is over two rooms, we quite like the sense of the space itself becoming a mirror. What informed Rose Davies' grid of paintings? It was to mirror the architecture of the space. So actually it sets the middle wall as a sort of mirror that reflects Rose's grid and the windows as being the sort of anchor points on either side. So we've sort of treated the architecture of the space to kind of encourage this idea of echoing or doubling. So we are looking at a sculpture by Tessa Whitehead. Tessa Whitehead is a Bahamian artist, lives and works in Nassau. And what we're looking at is a clay sculpture which is suspended from wire. It's really the kind of recollection of a skeleton, the feeling of a skeleton. So it's a sensation of actually being inside the body, as we all have been, feeling how your bones feel, feeling how your spine feels. I was so surprised when I spoke to Tessa that she said she had no reference materials. It was all kind of through sensation and memory, very beautiful and poetic, but also being quite disturbing. Your body, she has kind of replicated that in the clay, but then they're held together with cable ties, bits of wire, bits of rope. So the second one is much taller. It's also much more intricate. Its legs are attached to its arms. The rib cage is kind of collapsed in on itself. Seeing the two skeleton sculptures, they very much remind me of drawings. When you're starting thinking about working with an idea or something you've seen or heard and you want to try and capture it, I think, you know, she started to do that in the first skeleton and, you know, it's like you're feeling your way through it. She's gone back to this a second time, feeling more confident that, you know, the spine is the first thing, the head, and then she started to kind of add on these other parts. So it actually becomes something that has much more presence, I think. This one has more personality. What has been intriguing is, you know, this idea of twinning that Sid mentioned earlier. So, like, Gucci's new campaign has been using twins and the same outfits. There's a show with Ingleby Gallery of Peter Liveridge called Echo, and it's the same work. And then I think it's the National Gallery in Washington has just had a show which is doubling. So there's obviously something in the air. What we've done is slightly different. They're not exactly the same. It's more the idea that's kind of being doubled rather than the specific works. They're not identical. But even so, it's just been quite intriguing that there's obviously lots of this going on for whatever reason.
Our reference point starts in 1600. So actually, perhaps it's of the zeitgeist now, but something that's, you know, been around for a very, very long time. Mm. So it's, yeah, it seems like a right moment to put the exhibition.
That was Sid Motion and Rose Davey there. And Same Same is now open at the Sid Motion Gallery and will run until the 22nd of October here in London. And that's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to all my guests. And thanks to the producers, Carlotta Ribello, Laura Kramer and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our researchers were Lillian Fawcett and Emily Sands. Our studio manager was Nora Hall. After the headlines, more music on the way, The Briefing's live at midday in London and The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.